Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light, 3-0, and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. It is Thursday, August 31st. Can't believe we're in the last day of August already. Derek Van Riper, Britt Drolli, Eno Saris, all here with you on this episode. We will check in on the NL Central battle that heated up this week as the Cubs took 2 of 3 from the Brewers. We'll look at the broader playoff picture in the National League for a few minutes. We'll check in on the Tampa Bay Rays, the recent run of the Seattle Mariners, and we have an official announcement from the White Sox, something that we thought might be happening about a week ago. We have a new GM, and it is Chris Getz. So a lot of ground to cover here over the next hour or so, but let's begin in the NL Central, where America is just riveted by a battle between the Brewers and Cubs. The Cubs took 2 of 3 in the series, and they had underdog status in each pitching matchup, and I say that as someone who fully respects what Justin Steele has been doing this season, but it was Justin Steele against Corbin Burns on Tuesday. It was Kyle Hendricks against Brandon Woodruff on Wednesday, and the Cubs got 2 huge wins to cut the Brewers' lead to 3 games in the NL Central. I actually want to start with Justin Steele. You know, Justin Steele is 3rd in ERA among all pitchers, minimum 100 innings, going back to July 1st of last season. This is a guy that averages about 92 on the fastball. When you watch him, it sure seems like it's more about locating and sequencing really well as opposed to having just filthy swing and miss stuff. But he's getting fantastic results, and he's become a really important piece for this Cubs team.
Yeah, there was a thing on MLB Network where they put Justin Steele up against Spencer Strider. And they put their ERAs up, and they put their stuff plus up, which is a number that I helped create that sort of looks at the physical characteristics of their pitches. And they were sort of discussing how could Justin Steele have this much lower of an ERA when Spencer Strider, who has like the first or second best stuff plus in baseball, outranks him so much. And I was like, I don't know that there's any one number, first of all, that encapsulates all of a starting pitcher. Even ERA, FIP, WAR, any of these numbers, I don't think that any of them is that great. And then second of all, is this not the oldest battle in the history of time and talking about pitchers? You know, like, we've got the high stuff, fire-breathing monster. Like, I grew up in Atlanta, dude. We had John Smoltz and Greg Maddux, and we always, everybody in that was sitting there in a boring-ass game in August was saying, who you got? John Smoltz, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, who you got? And we argued about this stuff forever. And I think Steele is a little bit closer to a Maddux type. It's a little bit more a modern one because it's not a sinker. It's a cut ride fastball. He's a good locator. He's a really good locator. And Spencer Strider is John Smoltz. I mean, like, very similar. It's like a huge fastball, huge slider, strikes everybody out. And I don't know, me personally growing up, I was a Smoltz guy. So, yeah, I'm going to take Spencer Strider if you're comparing him to Justin Steele. I'm sorry. I think that, you know, I'll take the stuff every day. But Steele definitely has something going for him, which is sort of unique fastball or just a rarer type of fastball. It's a cut ride fastball that doesn't really have the jump of a four seam. It doesn't really have the fade of a two seam still. You know, there are other cut ride guys. His is more about location. I think he's a very good pitcher. I would take the best pitchers on the Brewers over Justin Steele.
All that being said, this Cubs team, Britt, is probably a bit better than people want to give them credit for. One thing they've done particularly well all season long is put runs on the board. They are 6th in the league in runs scored per game. They're one of only 6 teams that have averaged more than 5 runs per game this season. So as you start to assess this roster, How do you think they stack up to the other teams that are in the thick of the NL wildcard and playoff race, just from a more broad perspective? Because the Cubs feel like one of the less discussed teams in the National League to this point this season.
Yeah, I think they're a sneaky, dangerous team. And it's funny, I was talking to a GM 2 days ago about this, how they changed the complexion of the trade deadline, because as we've talked about, the hitter market was a big zero, pretty much. But a big part of that is because the Cubs felt like they were in it. So they hung on to Cody Bellinger, who was would have been a real impact bat for another team had he moved. He would have been like the top offensive player to switch teams. But, you know, they rightly, unlike the Angels, who wrongly read the tea leaves and said, you know what? I like where we're going here. And as we sit here today, they are, I believe, they're right behind the Phillies in the NL wild card. Two games back
of
the Phillies.
Only 3 games back of the Brewers.
In that NL wild card. Yeah. So like what stands out to me is, as you mentioned, the offense, also the run differential. So they're pitching and they're hitting, right? They're plus 77 on the run differential, which is better than a bunch of teams in front of them. Now, it's not the be all and end all, because you can have blowouts that kind of skew it, but they've been fairly consistent, I feel like, as a team, especially when the front office says, hey, we're not going to sell. We believe in what we're doing here. Even though this wasn't supposed to be a year that the Cubs were good, people were still kind of waiting on the rebuild to end. They were waiting on the Cubs to return to, you know, the glory of yesteryear, if you want to call it that. I personally think they underachieved a little bit in that window, one World Series. They did have some really good seasons, but I think that window where they were good, that last crop, was a little overhyped versus what they could have done if you look at it on paper. But certainly with this Cubs team, I have friends in Chicago that are like, hey, are they for real? You know, because people were planning on not having the Cubs play in October. And now I think a lot of people would be disappointed. And I think it would be considered a disappointing season for the Cubs if they missed the postseason, which you wouldn't have said a month ago. I might not have said it 3 or 4 weeks ago, but they continue to hang around. They continue to play good teams well, as you guys were talking about. And to me, they're a team that could easily still win the division and nobody would be surprised. They are a deep team offensively. Their young guys have started to perform well. I think they're in a pretty good spot to be one of those like sneaky teams where if they sneak in, why can't they do what the Phillies did last year? I don't think their lineup is as vaunted. I don't think it's as deep as Philadelphia's was a year ago. But we've seen crazy things happen in the playoffs. All it takes is a team to get hot at the right time. It takes a hot month, really. A hot 2 weeks to change the total fate of your season in October. So I like the Cubs, and you're right. I don't think we've talked about them enough. Now, certainly, as Eno said, I'm going to side with Spencer Strider, who I found one of the most fascinating guys at the All-Star Game to talk to. You know, if you talked to him much, you would have loved him.
Yeah, I mean, I love Spencer.
He went on. This surprises me none. He went on for like an hour to my one question about like, what would you change? What adjustment? That story we did, you know, what adjustment would you have changed? And he was like, so just like visceral and everything. And just like there were layers to everything he was talking about. I'm like, man, this guy is an Eno Saris guy. surprises me none that you like him, because he pitches like John Smoltz, but he has this mind that to me is just, it's fascinating. You can tell why he's a good pitcher. Right? He doesn't just go up there and rely on stuff alone. He is just a really, really interesting thinker.
Yeah.
Not to get off topic, but I wanted to mention that. I was blown away by him at the All-Star Game this year. You know, you get to talk to so many different guys and so many different stars. And this guy just had it all. He was confident. He was self-assured. He was smart. He was thoughtful. He was very nice to everybody, despite it being kind of an annoying setup in general. You get asked the same question 100 times.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad he's an Eno Saris guy already, because I said to myself, like, man, Eno's going to love this guy.
I like what you said about the Cubs being deep, though. I'm just looking at their roster, and you know, if you put Jaime Candelario in the regular group, you know, since the deadline, they have like 10 or 11 guys that are just comfortably above average with the bat. They have some ability to mix and match and platoon, and they're doing that and getting the most out of Patrick Wisdom. Jaime Candelario looks like maybe one of the best bats that was traded at the deadline. It was a bad year for trading bats at the deadline, but they bought the best bat at the deadline instead of selling the best bat at the deadline. And then I think just one thing I also wanted to mention about the Cubs is that you were talking, Derek, about the sort of Angels miscalculation, perhaps. I think it's important sometimes to like look at your division, even if you're not necessarily making decisions based on the division. You know, you have to play your division a lot. You have to think about how much quality is generally in your division and in the rest of your season. Cause you always finish, like the Cubs finish with the Brewers, right? You know, like you always finish with teams in your division. And I think the Angels made a miscalculation about how good the Mariners, I mean, we maybe all made that miscalculation, how good the Mariners were, but then you're like the Astros and Rangers are clearly better teams than you. So you're this whole thing you're doing is for a wild card. That seems like maybe a mistake. Whereas the Cubs, they can say, you know what? In our division, there's no team that's way better than us. You know, like we're good. We're as good. Like, yes, the Brewers probably have better pitching, but we have better hitting. The Reds may have better young hitting maybe, but they have some problems in the bullpen and in the rotation. And so like, you know, if you look at the landscape, you say, yeah, we could maybe even win the division. We'll make decisions based on winning the wild card, but we can maybe win the division.
This is a division that could put two teams in the postseason, which I think that 2 months ago would have been laughable. Yeah. Right? I mean, think about how the depth in this division with the Reds, the team they became by calling up a bunch of players earlier in the season, the Cubs, the form they have taken on. I mean, the second half for the Cubs has been fantastic. It's not just this last couple of weeks. It's a 29-15 stretch in the second half. So 14 over 500. They had a really rough patch in May. They went 10-18 that month, but they've been 500 or better every other month so far this season. This is just a classic, you know, which flaws would you rather have? Would you rather have problems in the back of your rotation like the Cubs, or would you rather have major problems putting runs on the board consistently if you're the Brewers? The Brewers ended this series red hot too. So to really stop them in their tracks and win the two games in the pitching matchups they did, that was a huge momentum shift in this battle. There's a couple of questions kind of folded in here. Which team do you think wins the division, and do you think they both get into the playoffs regardless of who wins it?
Ooh.
Because a lot of this hinges on how you feel about the Giants and the Diamondbacks in particular. It kind of seems like the Phillies are safely tracking towards being in, but it's those two West teams that you're thinking a lot about as far as who's truly battling with the non-winner of the NL Central.
I don't know, though, here. You're saying it's just those guys? I mean, if you look at it, Cincinnati's still in the mix.
Yeah, they're still there. 14.9% chance of making the playoffs. They're sliding down toward long shot status, but they're still alive.
Miami's sliding, too. And the Padres are dead, right? We're calling time of death on the Padres.
I guess so, yeah.
Kind of have to.
That waiver claim deadline is upon us as we record, so we'll see what AJ Preller really thinks. If he does nothing, I think that would be your final...
If he claims Lucas Giolito, I'm going to laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, if they were even close yesterday, one of the guys on the Rays, I was in Miami, which we'll get to later, but he was like, you know, if San Diego was even 500, they would have claimed all those guys.
Yeah, totally. But 10, right? 10 games under is pretty rough.
It's hard to sell. They're a team that gambled and pushed their chips in. They didn't really have another good option, right? Otherwise,
I mean,
and have just tanked.
I think the Phillies are a better team than the rest of the wild card contenders. So I'm going to put the Phillies in. So then you're talking about two spots and Cubs, Reds, Giants, D-backs, basically for those two spots. I'm going to give the Cubs one of those spots.
Yeah, or the Brewers. I think the Cubs could still win the division.
Yeah, Cubs or Brewers. Like, I'll give the loser, the second place NL Central team, I'll give them the other spot. And then, so I think it's really D-backs, Giants, Reds for one spot. I mean, I know there's only two games separating those guys from the Cubs, but just in terms of like teams and flaws and stuff, like, you know, Marcus Stroman is throwing again. I don't know if he'll pitch this season, but he's throwing again. They've managed to scrape together. The Cubs have managed to scrape together a good enough rotation to win. They have good offense. Their defense isn't a big flaw. The Reds have the second or very worst defense in baseball, depending on where you look. The Brewers have the best defense in baseball, or the second best, depending on where you look. So the Brewers are like, hey, we've got the best defense in baseball. We've got one of the best pitching staffs in baseball. And we're just trying to scrape together enough offense. The Reds are like, we've got all the offense. We just lost Nick Lodolo, and we have zero defense. I think that's more flawed. And the Giants and D-backs are just like, we're piecing together teams here. I bet you if the D-backs get Ronaldo Lopez, I think that could actually be like push them into favorite status for that last thing, because the D-backs bullpen is one of the, it's like the Reds defense. It's like one of the worst flaws in this group of teams.
Yeah, you look at what just happened to the Diamondbacks too. The Dodgers had a 3-game series with them this week. That was a absolute slaughter fest. 23-5, they were outscored. Dodgers have done this to a bunch of teams. Dodgers are playing really, really well right now.
Insanely well.
Any thoughts that they weren't the Dodgers anymore? Oops, that was on me. They have erased those over the last couple of months. They just look as nasty as they always are. And one thing we're going to talk about on the Friday show with Keith Law is Ryan Pepiot emerging to maybe be a key arm for them with some improved control. But the Diamondbacks definitely need some help from this group at the waiver deadline. I think both the NL Central teams make it. The Cubs actually have the easiest remaining schedule in the NL by that Fangraphs winning percentage calculation the rest of the way. They do see each other. The Cubs and Brewers play the final series of the season in Milwaukee.
That division,
that's
going to
be a big one. Yeah, and it really could come down to the very last day for that division title versus being the lower seed in the postseason. But I'm on the side that thinks both of these teams get in. I think I still have enough questions about the Cubs' depth that in the rotation, where I think that's going to be a problem for them, easier schedule or not, that's the part of their roster that I think is going to be exposed over the final month of the season. So I think the Cubs are the wild card and the Brewers by a whisker hang on to get the division.
There's this idea that Carlos Carrasco of the waiver claims. So I think the waiver claims are going to be mostly eaten up by the Giants, D-backs, Reds, and Twins.
Yep.
Those are
the fringy teams.
They get first
for
dibs,
the postseason.
Right? They get first dibs. Yes. Yeah. So,
which isn't fair, by the way. Kevin Cash went off about this yesterday, and it's true. Are they going to change this? Because it behooves you to be bad or fringy a playoff team in August.
I don't know. That's and only if this becomes a trend and there's a ton of players. I mean, there's most of the time that's you're not like super excited about the waiver deadline, you know, the waiver situation in August 31st, you know?
Yeah, I do think maybe they changed the rules where if you acquire a guy at the trade deadline, you have to keep him.
You can't waive him
for the rest of the year.
Yeah, that's an interesting
idea.
Yeah,
you can't waive him a month later. Mm-hmm. You can waive guys who've been on your team all year or prior to the deadline.
I mean, there could be something. I mean, I don't think it's that unfair. I mean, it's just the waiver process has been, that's been a thing that's been around forever. You know, the worst teams.
Yeah, but there's never been this many guys on it where like you could really affect playoff races.
That's true. That's true. I wonder if there'll be a rule change. But in any case, I think the Giants, D-backs and Twins and Reds will get, you know, Giolito, Ronaldo Lopez, Matt Moore. These are like the
Clevinger. I don't know if someone pays that salary though.
Clevinger. Yeah. There's some question of like who has 4, 6, 8 million dollars left to pay these guys. But I think most of the teams will, those teams will each make like two claims, the two best players, and they'll mostly pick them up. But there's been this idea that maybe Renfro and Carlos Carrasco will make it all the way through and be league minimum guys that are available. Do you think that the Cubs who sit behind this group might actually just say, hey, let's just pay Carrasco's salary the rest of the way? It doesn't seem like a great deal. He's not a great pitcher, but we don't have a great starting rotation. Wouldn't Carlos Carrasco be better than our fifth best starting pitcher right now?
That's a great idea.
That really depends on the health of Marcus Stroman, because if Stroman comes back soon, Steele, Stroman, Hendricks, Tyon's good first four. Javier Assad's been really good too in doing it similar ways to Justin Steele, where you look at the outside and you're like, wait, these results with that arsenal?
Yeah.
How is that happening? So arguably, for me, it just comes down to whether or not Stroman's healthy, because Jordan Wicks is the guy that's filling in right now. Like Wicks versus Carlos Carrasco, that's a coin flip at this stage of Carrasco's career. So I can see that maybe being a fit.
That's rough, dude.
Carrasco just looks so cooked, unfortunately.
But sometimes if you go to a new organization, they see something, it could change the way.
He might even throw a little harder. It's the end of it's a winning team.
Could
you
rejuvenate
know?
You. Stroman got hurt on rehab assignment. So I don't know if you can, even if you feel good about where he's at, I think you still make the claim because, you know, I honestly, maybe this happens and, you know, maybe by the time this records, I look like an idiot. I'd be surprised if he made it through Carrasco just because so many teams
could just use another, an extra starter arm. Yeah.
Like, yeah, it'd be great to pay him minimum instead of what he's owed. But like the Orioles, like could use it like Giolito ain't getting to the Orioles. Right. So
Yeah, I bet you. I bet you the only people who make it through out of this group are Renfro, maybe, and Jose Cisnero is just like a reliever for the Tigers. I think, you know, he might make it through. But even then, yeah, could you use an extra bullpen arm? Yeah. So I think it might be sad, but Renfro might be the only one who makes it through.
So who do you think ends up being the most impactful waiver addition of all the players that are available? It includes Giolito, Ronaldo Lopez, Randall Grichuk, Hunter Renfro, Matt Moore, Harrison Bader, Josh Donaldson, Britt mentioned Clevinger, Carlos Carrasco, Cisnero.
Bader?
You think Bader is the guy?
No, I just think he's more interesting than people are saying. I didn't know if you said him, so I was just thinking about him. I just sort of said his name out loud. Oh. I don't know if I would.
Giolito.
I think Giolito is probably the answer. Although, I think Giolito. Bader and Ronaldo Lopez are role players that may have an outsized contribution, because Bader is the best defensive, maybe the best defensive center fielder in baseball, or second or third. And, there are teams that could use that. The Giants defensively are not great. In center, the Reds, I just said, are one of the worst defensive teams in baseball. So, you know, that. And then Ronaldo Lopez, I think, is a closer level arm. So to be able to add someone that can pitch your eighth inning in waivers, I think is pretty good. I think Giolito's the easy answer, but those two guys deserve mention.
Yeah, I could see it playing out that way for sure. I mean, Giolito, something's just a little off. It didn't work for him at all in Anaheim. It's been kind of a down year overall for him, but you never know. Get him into a third organization this year. Maybe we can have a nice September from him to close things out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's shift the focus over to the Tampa Bay Rays. Britt, you mentioned you're on the road. You got home just recently. You were on hand for the Rays two-game series with the Marlins, and you reported on The Athletic on Wednesday, Wander Franco now facing a second formal complaint in the Dominican Republic about an alleged inappropriate relationship with a minor. Three underage girls have now accused Franco of misconduct, so the worst story in baseball keeps getting worse. Pushing that aside, which is terrible, this team is playing well at a really odd time. And there was a point prior to this story even breaking where they didn't look like the team they were in the first half, but they're sort of putting it back together. And they're 11-4 in their last 15 entering Thursday, which is just improbable given the form that that lineup had taken over the previous 2 months.
Yeah, and if you look at it, at least as of yesterday, Wander Franco was still the guy with the highest WAR on that team. So, and he's not the only guy that they're missing, right? We know that like most of their rotation has been hurt. Shane McClanahan is done for the year. So it's really incredible, guys. But when you're around them and you're in the clubhouse and you're talking to guys, they're like, yeah, you know, we miss Wander. We miss his production. Yeah, we miss McClanahan. But like, yeah, we just keep going. And I think what's so interesting about the Rays is they very quietly had a pretty terrible July, which allowed the Orioles to get back into it. But if you look at it, every other month, they've had at least 18 wins. They've played at a ridiculous clip. And look at Randy Arozarena's July versus what he did in August. Look at Yandy Diaz's July versus what he did in August. Like, these are guys that I think really, as the Rays go, they go kind of guys. So when you look at the lineup and what it's been able to do without Wander Franco, it's a surprise, at least to me. But then you look at what the Rays have done over the years, and as somebody pointed out, the Rays' worst player, their 26th guy on the 26-man roster, is another team's, you know, 20th, right? They're just so much deeper than every other team. And guys talk about that. They talk about the fact that, yeah, someone else just comes up and, you know, we're good here. Like, they have such a chill, relaxed clubhouse. They didn't even have a team meeting after everything happened with Wander. They didn't even have like a, let's talk about this crazy catastrophic event that just happened to us and we all just got on a plane and flew to San Francisco. No, Kevin Cash didn't have a speech. None of it. They just went out and played and they won. And it is just really tough. And people have been trying for years to put their finger on the intangible, like what makes the Rays great, right? And I think it's a lot of things, but I also think we don't give Kevin Cash enough credit for what he does. Like, We had this conversation just yesterday. Brandon Hyde probably wins manager of the year, right? Because the Orioles are good and nobody thought they were going to be good. But the Orioles have had almost no major injuries. They really haven't.
Yeah, they've been pretty healthy.
The Rays, look at what the Rays have lost and look at what they've been able to do. How does Kevin Cash, if we're measuring manager of the year, how does Kevin Cash not get serious consideration considering the fact that they lost their best player in Wander Franco, who is not coming back this season? And that's not an admission of guilt. They're still investigating, but he's being investigated in the Dominican Republic. MLB is going to wait on their investigation until that wraps. So you're not going to see him this season. So they are playing without their best player. They're playing without their best starting pitcher. They didn't get a full season from Tyler Glasnow. Like, the list goes on and on and on injury-wise, and they keep winning. And I don't think anybody talks about the job that Kevin Cash is doing. They have used 37 pitchers already this year. 37 different pitchers already, and we are not into September. It's remarkable. They used 38 all of last year. They're going to blow by that number. They just keep getting it done. And again, it kind of goes under the radar because they're in a small market.
Something we've talked about for a long time, you know, is that they, in Tampa Bay, they do a better job stretching the roster than pretty much any organization in baseball. There's a handful of teams that do it on that level. I think the Giants are another example of it, where that next player up is usually better than most other teams' guy that has to fill in the event of any particular player's absence. That's part of how the Rays have had so much success throughout the last decade plus.
Yeah, and you know, we've got this thing open on Fangraphs, the roster resource, 26-man roster breakdown, and you can do a rank homegrown, so you can see like how many of the players on a roster are from their own organization. And we have this idea of Tampa Bay as a sort of player development powerhouse, except they rank 25th. And in fact, because it's the tie for 25th, they're the third worst organization for in terms of how many players are on their team are from homegrown. And by this definition, it's their number one in players acquired in trade. And, you know, if you look at the roster, you kind of get it because you're like, you know, you wonder what the definition is a little bit. But, you know, Yandy Diaz it came in a trade. Randy Arozarena came in a trade. Isak Paredes came in a trade. Hale Ramirez was a waiver wire pickup. You know, so Jose Siri came in a trade. These are a lot of players that have come in trades. And there's a lot of coming and going. There's a lot of like managing 26 through 40 on the roster. They're really good at having a 40-man roster, knowing what that is, having a ton of people in the IL and moving people around. And so what Kevin Cash does that I think is so brilliant is you get a little bit of that Bruce Bochy keep calm and carry on vibe from him, where, you know, it wouldn't have been very Kevin Cash-like to get out there and have like a panic team meeting and be like, what are we going to do about Wander Franco? No. You, what's way more Kevin Cash is, you know, what are you going to do about Wander Franco? I don't know. We'll find somebody to put in the lineup tonight. You know, we called up Basabe, you know, that's a Kevin Cash answer. You know, like we called up Basabe, we'll figure it out, you know? And so you get this, like, yeah, I think it's a really calming influence for a lot of players that have come from different places, you know, and we're come from different organizations. It might be great to have this sort of calming. Yes, he's very stat, you know, influence, and he works with the front office and all this. But I think a lot of it is just he's a calming influence for people that have come from different situations. And everybody wants to play every day. And he's like, hey, we're all trying to win. We're, you know, come together. We'll figure this out. So I think it's some of his demeanor, actually, that kind of is the glue for all this.
Yeah, I do think, you know, Kevin Cash for me is similar to what Craig Counsell does in Milwaukee. The newer, the younger generation of managers that played more recently that have kind of the analytics and old school kind of approach blended together. I think those are sort of the optimal managers that organizations want to have now. Like you think about the Guardians, Terry Francona maybe retiring at the end of the season. They need a manager like that, right? Every team looking for a new manager is probably looking for someone like a Kevin Cash because that's what the game has become. And managing people is always a huge part of the job. We talk about that all the time. Dealing with anything that a 162-game season can throw at you, it's really important, right? Crisis management. How do you deal with the problems that are going to come up inevitably with your roster? So I think that's something they've done really, really well. And they have guys that don't play on this team that would get a lot of playing time elsewhere. I look at Jonathan Aranda, has nothing left to prove at AAA, can barely crack the lineup for the Rays. It blows my mind, and they do it with platoons.
Curtis Meade is like a top 10 prospect on some sides.
Yeah, you know? Curtis Meade would have been an everyday guy much earlier in the season for most teams around the league. He's just trying to stick on the roster right now, and it's this way a lot for the Rays.
Yeah, the trades is so interesting, though, you know, because you're right. You have in your mind that they're homegrown, but they get these guys early. Isaac Paredes is 24 years old. Mm-hmm. He's having a terrific season. He said yesterday he's trying to get to 100 RBIs, 30 home runs. I mean, they just find these guys, and not even just the young guys, though. Look at Jake Diekman, who was a waiver claim. Mm-hmm. Look at his ERA in Chicago.
Jason Adam. And then he's been like, you know, these are guys they pick up.
Yeah.
You know?
Off the literal scrap heap.
Yeah, they do as well as any organization at identifying talent in other organizations that has not reached its potential. I think Paredes is a great example of that because I thought the Tigers had plenty of opportunity for him in Detroit. I thought he'd be a regular for them for the next few years going through their rebuild. He ends up getting traded to Tampa Bay last year, unlocks this extra level of power. We saw some flaws in that approach last season. Thought, okay, maybe this is what Paredes is. Even still, good part-time player. Nope, he's one notch better than that. It's really interesting, too, because when you look at Paredes in particular, everything that he does damage on is pulled. Right, it's a super pull happy approach. You look at the spray chart, the home runs, they're all clustered together on the left side of the chart. It's remarkable. I don't know how long an approach like that works, but it doesn't matter because once there are signs that it's not going to work anymore, they'll find the next guy. That's just the way this organization works. The bigger question, I think, with the Rays, thinking about the absence of McClanahan, how important he was to that rotation. Tyler Glasnow, there's more, I think, more pressure on keeping Tyler Glasnow healthy because he's just a notch above Eflin and Savali.
Yeah.
He's that guy. Yeah. But they've been able to get so much out of Eflin this year that Eflin looks more like a true number two than he ever has at any point during his career, at least. You can start to see it. And the bullpen, I think early in the year, we were a little more critical of this bullpen, maybe not having the same firepower that it had in recent seasons. It started to take shape again. They got Andrew Kittredge back. That's kind of huge. A guy that got hurt. I think he had Tommy John last year. Just got back recently. Fairbanks is healthy right now. Jason Adam, you mentioned before. Robert Stevenson was a small trade they made with the Pirates. Jake Diekman, Funk from the left side. Like it's all the ingredients, again, coming back together in that facet of the game. So in the instances where the rotation, especially in the back end, maybe it only gives them four or five innings, they've got plenty of guys to bring into the game that are going to give you some problems from a matchup perspective.
I think that one of the things that's really important about running a good organization is knowing what you can do internally, like what your coaches are capable of coaching up, and then applying that to your player acquisition strategy. So, I think that they look at things and they say, okay, well, we're actually pretty good at breaking balls. We've had a lot of success coaching breaking balls. So let's get players that are pretty good in all sorts of ways. Maybe they can spin it, but there's something non-optimal about their breaking ball. So Savali comes over, throws more sliders. Eflin comes over, they improve his curveball. They have him throw the curveball more. You know, they obviously have had a lot of guys who had a lot of success with breaking balls. Drew Rasmussen, before he went down, was throwing three breaking balls, you know? So they have this ability to sort of coach up breaking balls. So they look for guys that have a good breaking ball, but could they have a second breaking ball or third? Could they, you know, do this? And they've had a lot of success with doing that. Even Diekman's breaking ball has changed. Like it's definitely something about what their institutional knowledge about how to coach breaking balls and applying that to how they get players.
You look back at this team, the 22-6 start in April had everybody excited about this being a version of the Rays we'd never seen before. They've only had 1 month with a losing record, and it was a brutal month. They were 8-16 in July, but they have pretty much recovered from that completely with a stretch of 17-8 now over their last 25 games here in August. So, okay, so we did the same thing in the NL Central. Both the Rays and the Orioles are going to the playoffs. That's even clearer, of course, than the NL Central teams we just talked about. Who wins the division? Who are you taking right now?
It's all going to come down to, so they come to Baltimore in 2 weeks for a 4-game series.
That's going to be huge.
That's going to be it. And they're already talking about it too, or Tampa is at least. Like, that is the series that's probably going to make or break and decide who wins the AL East. I mean, it may obviously come down to later in September, but I think that's really going to show you like how these two teams stack up. Because for me right now, it's a little bit of a coin flip. You know, Tampa is playing like out of their mind, and Baltimore just hasn't slowed down either. I mean, for a while, we're like, nobody's ever going to take down Tampa in the AL East. And here comes Baltimore, like quietly putting together just like month after month of excellence. And I think the starting pitching for both of those teams is a little bit of a concern. We mentioned with the Rays, with all their injuries, like Glasnow, he has to stay healthy and he has to be an ace, right? The Orioles don't really have an ace. And I don't think, you know, they're so late in the waiver claim that order that they're not going to be able to pick up anybody. Yeah. So they're kind of stuck as is. And Jack Flaherty's been like what you kind of would expect. He's had some fine starts and some bad starts. So to me, it's going to come down to the rotation, because we know the Orioles can hit like up and down. Their lineup is just really, really good. But I don't know if I can pick a clear winner right now. I don't. Not to be all waffly on you,
I get the chance to not waffle. Yay!
Yes.
I'm in a very clear and firm prediction from Rays. Eno, because Britt is very undecided.
Wow. The Rays.
It's the Rays. Why? Why do you think it's the Rays?
Glasnow is an ace. Eflin is a number two. I think Littell is a fine 4-5. Savali is a 3. I think the only X factor on the pitching side for them right now, they got Fairbanks going, Stevenson going, Adam. They've got their A bullpen going. The only X factor for me is Taj Bradley. If he's going to be, you know, a swing man, a part of the bullpen, or a rotation piece, but I think they'll get him right. So I clearly favor the staff of the Rays to the staff of the Orioles. I do think on the batting side, I probably take the Orioles, but I think it's a little bit underrated, you know, offensively for Tampa. For the year, they have a better WRC plus than the Orioles, and for the last 30 days, they have a better WRC plus than the Orioles. So in terms of how they hit, this is a good, really good hitting team, Tampa. So if I'm going to take the lineup and I'm going to take the staff, I don't think defense is enough to separate them. And I wouldn't say that Tampa has a terrible defense. So
they made some really, really good plays in the Miami series.
Yeah, maybe I take Baltimore's defense, but that's not enough for me to be like, okay, Baltimore is going to win this division based on its defense. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, you're selling me, because the Bautista injury in the bullpen for Baltimore definitely
that
hurt.
Was sad. That's
that losing your best reliever and then just being one thinner in the A bullpen overall is a tough blow to deal with. And I think Grayson Rodriguez, since he coming back, be has ace. Been a lot better, right? We know he's got ace potential, sub 3 ERA over his last 8 starts. Kyle Bradish, I would say, is maybe the AL equivalent of Justin Steele in some ways, where if you're not an Orioles fan, or if you are not a fantasy player, you might not be aware of just how well Kyle Bradish has pitched this year.
Stuff Plus loves him.
Stuff Plus loves him. So if you look at the model, you are fully aware.
But Bradish, I think Grayson could be an ace, whereas Glasnow is an ace. Bradish, I think, is a good number two. So that's a good spot. But then after that, I clearly prefer most of the Rays pitchers.
Right, that's where it tapers off a bit. With Jack Flaherty, we just never know what we're going to get as far as the velo. No. And good Jack Flaherty is still very good, but it's like a 50-50 coin flip on any given start that he's going to have that velo and be that guy. And it's so frustrating.
Yeah, Eno was pretty good at, like, right away. Like, I feel like this podcast, while many others were like, oh, golf clap for the Orioles, we were like, didn't really like the move. And like, it's not like they're one of those teams that has the you know, if it was a hitter, maybe, because they've done such a great job of you know, hitters improving at the big league level, but they haven't done that pitching wise. So it didn't lend a whole lot of like, they're gonna uncover a secret with Jack Flaherty. He's gonna be like Jack Flaherty of 5 years ago. Like, you just didn't see that, right?
He's a fastball slider guy. What do you got to uncover? He's good when he throws 94 plus, and he's bad when he throws 93 minus.
And he gets really mad when you ask him about his velocity.
Yeah, don't ask him about it.
Yeah, no, it's true. But what's crazy, you know, is that like, you are the Rays don't have Shane McClanahan and Wander Franco, two who I would call their stars that maybe people who aren't Rays fans have still heard of these guys, oh, right? That man. Don't play fantasy baseball. And they still, I mean, it is so unbelievable. Kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It is so unbelievable, especially when you see like Aaron Judge and the Yankees and how bad they struggled without him. They're obviously an organization with a ton of flaws and issues.
And they spend a lot on player development. They care a lot about player development. They have an ethos in the minor leagues. They have plans. They create guys who hit the ball hard and don't chase. That sounds great, except they miss the ball all the time. When's the last time they created a young player like Wander Franco? Their guy, Anthony Volpe, is exciting. He misses the ball all the time. So, you know, it's like there's something about their approach that's not quite right. Otherwise, they have the resources to be able to turn out players like the Rays, and they haven't been able to do that.
Yeah,
I think Volpe is going to be better with time. I think he's going to make more contact over time.
But he'll never make as much contact as Wander did.
No, but think about the universe of prospects and the time that all of us have covered baseball. There's a very short list of players who were supposed to
Wander Franco,
to be on that level, right? So, throw that away. Like that's not a fair starting point anyway. Volpe is a 22-year-old rookie playing in the pressure cooker spot in Major League Baseball. You're the shortstop for the Yankees.
He's batting. Is it tonight or last night with Judge out? He batted third.
Yeah, it's like being the quarterback of the Cowboys, right? You're just gonna get extra scrutiny in that spot. And I know it's a little below average in terms of the overall value. It's a 92 WRC plus. That's not failure for a 22-year-old rookie to be just a tick below league average. That's actually a successful rookie season. There's power, there's speed. He's a good defender. Anthony Volpe is going to be fine. Your broader point, though, is something that I think is really interesting. How many quality big league position players have the Yankees developed over the last 10 years? I know they do make some trades, and maybe the organizational philosophy is let's try and get guys up to double A and flip them. And some of the key players in that lineup are guys they traded for. Aaron Judge, obviously a big hit. He was a first-round pick. We talked about this with player development a while back. How do you grade turning a first-rounder into a star? It's a little different than taking a fourth-rounder or a fifth-rounder and turning that player into a star. You still get credit. You still did some things right. Right? You were involved. You found the player. You didn't mess him up. You found the player. People had a lot of concerns about Judge when he came up saying, he's so big. He's got a huge strike zone. He's going to strike out forever. Wrong. It didn't work out that way.
The Cole signing looks like it's going to be like the Max Scherzer signing, which is, you know, by the Nationals, going to be one of the best starting pitcher signings of all time. So they do some things good, and then on player development, they do some things good. But like, to some extent, some of the chatter in the industry is that they just don't give those guys enough chance. That Oswaldo Peraza, Oswaldo Peraza should have been playing third base since like June. Full time for them. That Pereira and Jason Dominguez should have been up earlier. You know, that they should get a full ride. So hey, this interesting that in New York, Everson Pereira and Jason Dominguez are going to play in the outfield every day for the final month, and Anthony Volpe and Oswald Peraza are going to share the infield for the final month. So this is going to be, and they even brought up their catcher prospect, Austin Wells. So they're going to take five super young guys and just put them out there for a whole month and just say, you know, convince us that you're the starter next year. And that's a little bit different than they've had in New York. And I wonder if there's, you know, there's this pressure in New York to get to the playoffs every year. So how much, if we're in this crucible that we have to make the playoffs every year, how many times can I just be like, Jason Dominguez is our, you know, starting outfielder for the next month? You don't get that chance. So this year, maybe they make the most out of this. We're not making the playoffs. We're going to have a whole month to Jason Dominguez to, you know, just settle in. And then maybe next year, he's the starting center fielder from the beginning of the year. And he's going to have a great year. And everybody's going to be like, wait, the Yankees are good at player development.
It really will hinge on this group and the success this group has over time. I think they'll be judged faster than they should be because it's the Yankees.
But like I just did with the Baby Bombers were a massive, massive disappointment. And so people are like, well, we've seen this shtick before.
Right. Look, prospects.
I think as long as from the organization, they're not packaging their group of prospects that way again, and I don't there's no indication that they are, then the people Martian should be a little more reasonable.
Okay, that's a little Martian, bit more specific.
Did the Yankees do that, or no, did we, the media, do that?
Yeah, actually, exactly. He did it, I think. There's a clip of somebody saying he met him on the subway, and he had his glove, and they said, oh, did you catch a foul ball? And he said, I play. And then he said, oh, are you any good? And he said, I'm the Martian.
Yeah, he's just embraced it. I don't think he started the media. If he started calling himself the Martian at 16 years old, then that's confidence off the charts. Like confidence to the point of maybe being a little concerning.
Yeah.
Maybe a little too much, but playing really well in the second half of the season, and you know, nice to see him getting a look here at the end of the year. Not the year the Yankees fans wanted to see, but at least your team is doing what I would say is the right thing, doing something they haven't necessarily always done in the past, being willing to give that young talent an opportunity here late in the season. And that leads us to our next topic, which may be more of a flyby because we've already assessed how we feel about the White Sox going internal to fill their GM vacancy. It is Chris Getz. Chris Getz seems to be pretty well liked in circles, like from the public reaction I've seen. It's more of the contingent of people who cover the White Sox and White Sox fans saying, okay, but how are things going to be different? You worked in the previous regime. It's a completely fair question. But the question I want to ask each of you is, when you think about a major league organization, or even any organization, and there's a chain of command where there are people in charge, how often do people within the organization who are not at the top have ideas of their own? How often do they have a plan that they are not allowed to execute because they're not at the level of putting everything in place, right? So you can grade Chris Getz within the job that he previously had. You have to give him an incomplete out of the box for what he's going to do as a GM, even though I think we would all make the assumption or the hypothesis that more of the same is the most likely thing he will do until proven otherwise. But I think, as frustrating as this would be for White Sox fans, if you wanted James Click to be the new GM, I understand why, because he came from the Rays, spent time in Houston. It would have been a fresh philosophy heading up baseball operations. That, to me, seemed like a better outcome, you know, not knowing exactly what Getz is going to do. Is it fair to at least give Chris Getz a chance to see how he changes things in this organization, even though he's been there through the recent dysfunction?
No, I don't like this move at all. Listen, I got a bunch of text messages about this in the coming days. Some of them I can't read on air, but some of them I can. And they were like, what has this guy done but run a shitty farm system?
Yep.
True. True. This guy is what? Not even 40 years old. And he's been in an antiquated organization behind it every facet. And what does he get? Promoted. Like that's what this sport needs. Another mediocre white dude getting a job that really doesn't have the resume for.
Without an open process. You know, like I thought we were supposed to have an open process where you that's interview people and give people a chance to talk.
Yeah, like, but if they did that, it would have been a sham, right? They would have called in a few diversity candidates, had an interview and said, we picked Chris Getz. He's the best guy for the job. And people would have been mad about that too. But I did have that conversation with the scout and he's like, how can MLB let this happen? This is what the Rockies did too. So how can Dick Monfort and Jerry Reinsdorf, who are two of like the most, I think, longer tenured owners in the game, two of the guys who have more of the power.
There's your answer.
Uh-huh. So MLB creates all these nice diversity committees, and then these teams are just internal hiring?
Yeah, they have no teeth.
This is nothing against Chris Getz, who I have heard is a very nice guy. This is nothing against Chris Getz.
He must be.
But this organization requires innovation. It requires outside thinking. And as different as Chris Getz may be in, you know, the way he does things or the way he wants to lead, here's the other thing. Is he going to be able to lead an entire organization? That as much as we may think he thinks different than Kenny and Rick Hahn, how different can you be when you've been in that organization and they've done things this one way? It's not like he was in five or six different organizations before he came to the White Sox, right? But this all circles back to what we keep hearing, which is there's the White Sox way, and then that's it. In Jerry Reinsdorf's mind, loyalty is also like, let's keep my people. Let's keep the people in the White Sox organization in the White Sox organization, right? So they were never going to do anything to rock the boat. Who, in my mind now, wants this president job? I mean, it is a good job on paper, but like, I don't think we give Jerry Reinsdorf enough credit for being as meddlesome of an owner from what I've heard. So if they're really not going to change anything philosophically,
That's one of the texts I got. Nothing's going to change unless you change the guy just signing the checks.
Also true.
Right. And I think that's a fair position to take also. I'm trying to,
give him a chance?
Of any reason.
Make him an AGM then. Like, make him an assistant GM. Why does he... He's also not even a GM. He's like VP of baseball operations. It's a hell of a promotion.
Yeah, I don't even think they... Right. I don't think they'll sign a POBO.
That would be a massive failure, don't you think? Yeah, Ina's like, I don't know. They're in bad shape.
I mean, it just fits what... Okay. I mean, this already was. You're right. I think it already is.
yeah, but like they haven't even started that interview process. So who even knows? So... I don't know.
Just thinking about like Chris Getz's history, like, you know, yes, they are widely regarded as probably the worst player, one of the worst three, if not the worst player development situations in baseball. And we've been talking on this podcast today and often about how do you judge one. And one thing that I came up with was I'm looking at rank homegrown that I talked about earlier with Tampa Bay. And if you look at the top teams in terms of, homegrown teams, Cleveland, Colorado, Royals, White Sox, Houston. That's a really interesting fivesome, right? And you Tigers are right behind it. So there's six teams there that are the most homegrown teams in baseball. They have the most homegrown players. So I think it's actually fair then to port over to, you know, how is that team doing right now as a metric of their player development, because that team is built from inside. And so when you look at the very bottom of how hitters are doing this year, how team hitters are doing this year, and you see Colorado last, Chicago White Sox 28th, Tigers 27th, Royals 26th, and Houston 5th. I think that you can get, like, this is actually a proxy for how good your player development is, because those are homegrown teams and one is 5th and one is 28th. You know, like, so those are the players you wanted. Those are the players you developed, and that's what you're getting out of it. So I do think that it's a little bit fair to say that, you know, hey, he was in charge of player development. They have a lot of homegrown players on this team and they aren't good. So why are we promoting this guy? And then, you know, then you have the internal sort of, I've heard that their players don't get scouting reports before games. Maybe that's changed. Maybe they've gotten better at that. They've tried to hire certain, you know, I know they've had some high profile hirings, but the way they do it is they hired somebody I respect a lot to be like an analyst, like to help their analytics on their hitting side. And they gave him the title analytics coach, which is just an awful title to give someone that's coming into an old player development organization. It's like, hey, we got the nerd coach over here. Anybody want to listen to the nerd coach? And all the other coaches are like, we got an analytics coach over here, huh? What are you going to do, huh? You got some nerd numbers for our hitters?
I'm going to read you guys a statement from Reisdorf about Getz and try to not laugh while I make it through this. Chris has impressed me greatly over the past 7 years. In our conversations this season, I have become energized by his vision, approach, and sense of what this organization needs to become competitive again. With his existing knowledge of the organization top to bottom, I believe his leadership will provide us with the quickest path forward to our goal. A consistently successful baseball team that competes and plays the game the right way. He will re-energize this organization. He's been there. Why was he not energizing the player development? Anybody? Someone?
Why was he energized? Yeah, he was in leadership. It's not
Jerry Reinsdorf doesn't like searching for executives.
How much more is this leadership going to help him?
Which is why he kept Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn in their spots forever. The easiest thing for him to do was promote somebody internally rather than do a real search. But they will still, again, just keep spinning their wheels. And Tony La Russa is back now as an advisor, so he's probably the one whispering.
Oh, that I thought was the funniest of it all. Like, you can bring back Tony La Russa.
Right. So he's probably the one that Reinsdorf listens to the most. So really, who's running the Chicago White Sox? It's not Chris Getz. It's Tony La Russa and Jerry Reinsdorf. Does anyone feel better? I mean, it almost makes you miss Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn, to be frank.
Which franchise wins a playoff game, not even a whole series, a game next? The White Sox or the Angels?
Oof, I knew you were going there. I knew you were going there. 1A and 1B. You know what? The White Sox, because the Angels just blasted themselves back a decade with their trade deadline.
No. The prospects they traded away probably aren't going to be that good.
But that's because their system is bad. Those were their number one and two.
Right. So
who do you think are three and four? Better guys? There's no Mike Trout down there.
It's not the deadline. It's the 2 decades of already owning the team, right? It's not not what just happened a month ago. This isn't.
I feel like the Angels
are
closer to being sold. I might take the Angels because they might be closer to being sold.
Also, the White Sox are in the AL Central.
It's a great way to think about the problem.
Taking a depressing turn. But Perry Mathiasen's probably going to be the one whose head has on the chopping block. Like, his contract's up.
Well, yeah, a lot of possible changes in that organization. We have just a couple minutes. I just wanted to throw this on the conversation for a moment. The Mariners are also playing really, really well.
Now in kinder, more
uplifting.
Yeah,
let's get out of the bad place. Teams that are spinning in circles. Let's talk about the Mariners, where they have been on fire. I think one of the best teams in the second half. I saw second best record in August, which is hard to believe that the team's actually played better than them. But what do you attribute this recent stretch to? I saw 11 Mariners hitters with a league average or better WRC plus since July 1st. Everybody's hitting. Julio Rodriguez has played like a future MVP during that stretch. JP Crawford's been rolling. They've got 24 home runs in the last 2 months from Cal Raleigh and Eugenio Suarez, so the secondary contributors are providing the thump that they're supposed to. Josh Rojas looks like a different player. They got him at the deadline as part of the Paul Sewald trade. And the starting pitching has been excellent. Almost entirely as a group, they don't walk guys. It's not just George Kirby. It's Gilbert. It's Luis Castillo. It's Bryce Miller. 4 starters with a walk rate under 2 walks per 9 since July 1st. Just seems like a team that's doing everything right and putting all the pieces together that, you know, Britt, you called it at the beginning of the season as a hot take. You like the Mariners to win the World Series. It seems more realistic now than it has at any point this season.
Yeah, you know what? I did not see this coming, obviously. But what people don't realize, though, they've pitched all year. It was just like waiting for the offense to come alive, right? Julio had a really bad start to the season, and the offense in general hadn't gotten it done. And so I think once their offense got even to that league average or just slightly above spot, they were going to be a good team. The question was, could they make up ground? And that's why they needed this hot stretch to get back into things, or they were just going to end up being like a fringy team on the outside. But to me, the story here is the offense. The story is also that they traded their closer away and somehow are still good, which is a little baffling if you think about it. But the story to me is Julio and also the rest of that lineup finally doing what they were supposed to, because there were so many games and like road trips that were demoralizing for them early on when they were pitching well and they'd lose because they couldn't score any runs. And, you know, this young pitching has held up. And I think a lot of people were kind of wondering like, hey, at the trade deadline, hey, is Seattle going to, going to push their chips in and make these young starters available, because that could have changed the scope of the trade deadline. And they didn't, which was confusing because people were like, well, does DePoto still think they're going to win even though they traded away their closer? You know, it was like this weird in between. And now they're clearly all in and they're winning and they're dressing up in like Run DMC outfits. Did you guys see this with bucket hats? And like, oh, it's on. Julio Rodriguez put it on his Instagram, the whole team. And I don't know why, but Scott Servais, who's like, what, a 50-year-old man, dressed like this was hysterical to me. The track pants, the bucket hat. And then Run DMC comes on FaceTime and like pumps them all up before they get on the plane. It was amazing. Nice. So it's all going well in Seattle. And to me, it all, like, can this last? All again rides on the offense, which we know teams go through hot and cold stretches. But if Julio Rodriguez is truly going to become the leader of this team, which he's still a little young for and kind of growing into that role, he has to continue playing at this like MVP caliber rate, in my mind anyway, to really separate themselves, because that AL West is nuts right now. Houston's always lurking. They were always lurking. The Rangers, who I thought was the best team, and who I still think is probably the best team on paper, have some problems as well. So it is probably the most interesting. Sorry, Derek, I know the NL Central is also close, but to me, it's probably the most interesting division race.
It's three teams,
and they're all legitimately good, fun
teams.
That's always more fun.
They might be all better than the Brewers.
hey, you don't have to like go out of your way to take the shot. The Mariners' offense is actually very good, tied for 5th in the league with the Astros with a 109 WRC+. The key key difference is that the Mariners strike out a lot. They are second league-wide in team strikeout rate behind the Twins. So that's where I think that feast or famine concern for the lineup can come from, right? They can hold their own against top-level pitching. I think they're capable of that. When the K's are a problem, that's when things could cool off for them. The good news for the Mariners, that pitching's really solid. Even without Robbie Ray, that's a really good rotation. They could afford to trade Seawald at the deadline. You got to give Jerry Dipoto credit for being willing to trade a good, popular veteran reliever who was important in that bullpen, knowing that he could get something back that would help between Rojas and Canzone, and knowing that he had enough in that group to not lose anything in the late innings, or not lose a lot in the late innings.
He knew that he's like me with my fantasy teams. I'm always trading pitching for hitting because, you know, hitting is really hard to put together, especially in a stadium like Seattle's. And so he knew that losing some of the outfielders that he's had and just generally needed more bats. And, you know, you speak of their strikeout rate. Dominic Canzone, the guy, kind of the primary guy that came back in that Paul Sewald trade, does not really strike out that much. So I think that was part of what he was trying to do, is add somebody to the lineup that did have some pop but also didn't strike out that much. Otherwise, they control the zone, and they're an exciting team. You know, my youngest wanted the troll of the family, he wanted us to have a team that he decided that we would follow, and he chose the Mariners a month ago, and he thinks that J.P. Crawford is one of the best players in the big leagues. I can't tell him no. In the last month, J.P. Crawford has hit .280, .427, .469 with three homers. 57% better than league average. JP Crawford's been great. And so they have a type where they acquire guys that don't strike out and don't necessarily hit the ball super hard. And like JP Crawford went on a trip to Driveline, did weighted bats and tried to increase his power. I think they hope to get guys that control the zone, make good contact, and coach up the power. I think that's part of what they hope with Canzone. And then otherwise, so that's very Cleveland Guardians-esque. And on the pitching side, they're Cleveland Guardians-esque as well. You're talking about how they don't walk anybody. They love command when they draft a starting pitcher and when they acquire a starting pitcher. They love command because they think that they can coach up the stuff. They have an internal stuff plus, very much like mine, that they use to help coach up Kirby and Gilbert and Wu and all these guys that are coming up. So, in a sense, like, the Mariners are a more successful version of the Guardians with a lot of the same values. I think they've also, like, supplemented with guys who strike out a lot, who have a lot of power. That's something the Guardians haven't been willing to do. So getting a guy like Suarez, Eugenio Suarez, that's not something I think that the Guardians would ever do. He strikes out too much. Well, guess what? When he's white hot and blistering hot, he can carry the lineup. You know, so having somebody, you know, having a lineup that's generally good, but then adding some strikeouts is not always bad. Variance is not always bad. Volatility is not always bad. Sometimes that means you're white hot at the right time. And that's sort of what Seattle's doing right now.
Yeah. One last thought here as we go. We're running a little bit long, but the Mariners have now passed the Twins for the best strikeout minus walk percentage league wide among the pitching staffs. 17.9%. Twins have been atop that list for most of this season. Twins are still at 17.8. They're second. But the teams that are on that leaderboard, the teams that pitch well just by K minus BB percentage, almost across the board are going to be playoff teams. Mariners, Twins, Blue Jays, Rays, Marlins, probably a miss, Braves, Giants, Phillies, Orioles, Brewers, Astros. Yankees are 12th, Dodgers are 13th. Wow.
That's why some teams make that shirt, control the zone. It's like a spring training shirt, you know, control the zone.
Perhaps an indication of things to come. The Cubs, 18th, a little bit lower than those other teams.
When they hired Scott Harris to run the Tigers, they asked him, like, what's something you believe? And he said, you know, most of the game is about controlling the zone. Most of the game happens right there.
All right. Well, we're going to get some Control the Zone t-shirts made for this podcast in the time that I am gone. Leg 2 of paternity leave starting up for me, so you will not be hearing me in September. I will be back in October, so either good news if you like me or bad news that I'm coming back eventually if you don't. Sorry to break it to you. On Twitter or X, you can find Britt at Britt underscore Droli. You can find Eno at Eno Saris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. We got a special going right now. Subscriptions to The Athletic are just $1 a month for the first year at theathletic.com/baseball show. That's going to do it for us. We're back with you on Friday.
Always got the green light here.
Green light.